I want to continue talking about the creation record in Genesis chapter 1. And I made the point in the first presentation that the Hebrew word Eretz, that's translated earth, refers not simply to the whole planet, it can refer to that, but many times in the Bible it refers specifically to the land promised to Abraham from the Euphrates to the river of Egypt. And I started off by saying Genesis 1 verse 1, in the beginning, which is not a moment in time, but the Hebrew can quite comfortably mean the first section, the first part of, say, the beginning of the reign of a king, that in the beginning God created everything. And then there is this zoom onto the Eretz Israel, that out of the whole of the cosmos, God focuses upon the land and particularly upon man upon it, upon Adam. And then in chapter 2 you have the repeat of the creation account, but specifically talking about Eden, which I suggest is the Eretz Israel, and particularly man, Adam, within it. Now, this approach to the Eretz is, I think, helpful in understanding a lot of the issues which arise in Genesis. Sons of God marrying daughters of men. Was the flood universal? Tower of Babel, really, did we all descend from Noah? Is it really so that all the world's languages suddenly appeared after the Tower of Babel incident? These are common questions, and I suggest that they all have their answer in understanding that the focus of the Bible, particularly of Genesis and of the Pentateuch, is upon this Eretz, as in the land promised to Abraham, and not upon the whole planet. Now, the Pentateuch, I suggest, was written by Moses, and it was written by Moses to explain to the wilderness generation who'd been in Egypt for 430 years, who had been listening to all these various myths of creation that they'd heard from the Egyptians and all these other people with whom that they had mixed and who they were probably meeting as they travelled through the wilderness. They were ignorant, really, of their God, of their own history. They didn't know where they were coming from or where they were going to. And so the Pentateuch explains that. Now, for reasons of style and various allusions to Babylon and Babylonian myths, I would posit that the Pentateuch was rewritten under inspiration of God whilst the Jews were in captivity in Babylon. And that goes for a lot of the Old Testament. So then, just taking the Eretz then as referring to the land. It starts off then in Genesis 1 with the whole land covered in water, that it's orderless and formless. And then the Spirit of God flutters upon it, hovers upon it, and makes something absolutely beautiful out of it. Now, that is appropriate to Israel in the wilderness, wanting to know what's the game plan, where are we coming from. This all seems pointless. It's relevant to the Jews sitting in Babylon with their land destroyed. There we sat down, there we wept when we remembered Zion, and it all seems so far away and so formless and pointless and in ruins. And yet the message then of creation is that that same power that operated then is operating today, to create for you, whose lives appear formless and judged and meaningless, something exquisitely beautiful. And that, of course, applies to us as well. That same God who commanded the light to shine out of darkness, Paul says, has shined in your hearts to give the light of the knowledge of God in the face of Jesus Christ. And so, when you come, for example, to this issue of the flood, was the flood universal? Well, there's fairly big problems in trying to argue that the whole planet got flooded, and there was water above the highest mountains on Earth, on the whole planet, and that every possible kind of plant species died out, and that every possible kind of animal species died out. And that all the animals were put inside the ark, and that they had the right kind of food for all of them, etc. This creates a lot of problems, especially to argue that from that time, somehow kangaroos and marsupials got to Australia, somehow leaving no traces of themselves anywhere else, none of them staying behind anywhere that they managed to, I don't know, hitch a ride on a passing tree trunk or something and get out of Australia and didn't go anywhere else. You know, there's whole stacks of problems with this. Now, I would go with Robert Roberts in his view of a local flood. But why I would say it is on the basis of this word Eretz and the way that it is used so often in Genesis, not about the whole planet, but specifically about the land promised to Abraham from the Euphrates to the river of Egypt. And I would go further and say that, all right, after that happened, Noah emerges from the ark with Shem, Ham and Japheth, and nobody else apart from their wives. And then in Genesis 10, after the flood, you have this table of nations, the descendants of Shem, Ham and Japheth. Now, nearly all the 70 or so nations that are listed there, you meet elsewhere in the Bible, and they are all within that territory. That is from the Euphrates to the river of Egypt. They are an explanation to Israel in the wilderness. Who are all these tribes we keep bumping into? Who are these guys? Ah, yeah, okay. They came from Shem, Ham and Japheth when this area was flooded. Now, all the attempts to try to explain that Chinese people came from this one and black people came from this one and white people came from this one and so forth, you know, from Shem, Ham or Japheth, these are pathetic, quite frankly, that they are pathetic. That's just bunk science and bunk exposition of the Bible. That much is so. The Bible itself gives us the list of the descendants of Shem, Ham and Japheth, and they are all located in that land, that territory from Euphrates to Egypt. So I would say that there on biblical grounds is the reason to accept that the flood and its aftermath affected specifically that area. And as I say, that helps us through a lot of these problems with logistical problems of how on earth did all the animals get inside the ark, and how were they gathered, and how did they then redistribute all over the earth? Now, the language that's used about the state of things in the Eretz in Genesis 6, when it says that it was all sinful, etc., is exactly the language that's used by the later prophets about the state of sinfulness in the land of Israel. Now, the Pentateuch, as I say, was to explain to Israel about what they were encountering on their journey. Now, in Numbers 13, verse 33, we read that they were frightened by the giants that they met and heard of in the land of Canaan. And I suggest that there in Genesis 6, when we read that the sons of God married the daughters of men, and they had large offspring, that these were the giants. This is the explanation to Israel. Those very strong, tall people that you met in heard of in the land of Canaan, you know where they came from? They came as a result of God's children, you, the sons of God, marrying the daughters of men, the people outside the Eretz, and this is what happened. So I suggest that a lot of the problems that arise in the earlier chapters of Genesis are explicable if we understand that this is talking about this Eretz. Later on, within the law of Moses, it's quite clear that that law applied within that territory. For example, when you've got the list of which animals are clean and unclean, all those animals that are mentioned are animals within the land, within the Eretz of Israel, the territory that was promised. Now, when you come to later scripture, I suggest that you've got a similar sort of understanding. Because later on in the Bible, it keeps that the prophets keep on talking to the Jews in captivity in Babylon about the restoration of their Eretz back to the state it was in the Garden of Eden. Got this in Isaiah 51, Ezekiel 36, and in Joel, Jeremiah. They all talk about this, that your land that is now in ruins is going to be restored like the Garden of Eden. So I suggest that it's not simply saying it will be like Eden. It actually is talking about the actual restoration of Eden, because Eden is that land, that Eretz. And as I say, as Adam and Eve were sent forth to the east of the garden, so Judah were sent out of their land to the east, to Babylon. And of course, this is the significance of the mention that we have of how in Genesis 11 verse 1 that they went out from the garden to the east, and then they moved further east to Babel, which is Babylon. Same word. So that the whole thing is really does suggest that Eden was the land promised to Abraham. And I would even argue that when the ark comes down on Mount Ararat, this is not the Ararat that is in modern day Armenia on the Armenian-Turkish border. This word means the Holy Mount, and I suggest that was Mount Zion, but that's another story. Now, this idea that the Eretz refers to the land promised to Abraham, that territory, I think, you know, this is really crucial. You might like to have a look at Jeremiah 27, verses 5 and 6, where God says that he has made the whole earth, the whole Eretz, and has given it to the king of Babylon. I'll read it. I have made the earth, the Eretz, the men and the animals which are on the face of the Eretz, by my great power, by my outstretched arm, and I will give it to the one who is pleasing in my sight. And the reference is clearly to the king of Babylon. And then he goes on in verse 6 to define all the areas within all the earth that shall be given to Babylon. Ammon, Moab, Sidon, Tyre, etc. So then the whole earth that was created, or made, or prepared, as the Hebrew word can mean, that whole territory was given to the king of Babylon. But the whole earth there clearly is not talking about Australia, America, and Europe. That these were not governed by the king of Babylon, and the nature of all the earth is defined, as I've said, Ammon, Moab, Sidon, Tyre, and so forth. That all these places are within that territory that was promised to Abraham. So, Genesis 1, the earth, or the land, was formless and empty. Tohu wa bohu. And those very same words, formless and empty, in Hebrew, are used about the state, or the condition, of Israel after they had been exiled, after they had been judged. That's in Jeremiah 4, 23-26. I looked on the earth, on the land, and behold, it was formless and void. God says, tohu wa bohu, just exactly what you've got there in Genesis, that everything was empty, formless, and void. And I looked to the heavens, and they had no light. In other words, this is going back to how it was, as it were, in Genesis 1, verse 2, before God said, let there be light. The fruitful land was a wilderness. There was no man, no Adam, and all the birds of the heavens had fled. Well, that's pretty clear. That's pretty clear that we are to understand that scene in Genesis 1 as referring to the land, the Eretz that was promised to Abraham. Now, when we read that this whole situation, that this Eretz, this land, was formless and void and was a wilderness, this connects with the idea that this tohu, this word, the Hebrew word translated formless, it also means deserted, like a desert. Which is a rather odd thing to say about an area that is covered in water, that it's like a desert. But when you realize that, yes, this is a picture of divine judgment, then it starts to make sense. New American Standard Bible uses the word, instead of formless, wasteland. That back in Genesis 1, it was all a wasteland. And the same word is used about the wilderness through which Israel walked in Deuteronomy 32 verse 10. It was a wasteland. So again, you see the relevance for that generation in the wilderness who first heard these words. Here we are in a wasteland. Oh yeah, Genesis 1. That's actually how things were originally. It was all a wasteland. But out of this chaos, out of this formlessness, a garden, a place, a kingdom of exquisite beauty is being developed. And that's exactly what that's exactly the message that we need to hear. Because you can look at your own life and it can seem so formless and empty and so deserted. But that's where the Spirit of God comes in, hovering over the whole situation to make something of beauty, where man can live in service to God. And in Deuteronomy 32 verse 11, the next verse there, Deuteronomy 32 verse 10 says that Israel were in the wasteland, which is the formless place. Then verse 11 of Deuteronomy 32 says that God's Spirit, God hovered over Israel. That he was like a mother eagle hovering over. And it's the same word used in Genesis 1 about the Spirit of God hovering over the Eretz, over the land. So then, this formlessness was taken away by the Spirit of God, which was the agent of creation. And of course, it's that same Spirit, that same power of God, if we will allow it, that works in our lives to create this new creation, to allow this power of God to burst forth. Now, when you come to Isaiah's prophecies about how Judah are to return to the land and it is to be rebuilt in the time of the restoration, they're full of allusions to the language of creation and to the language of God's Spirit working. And I think that is understandable because, yes, that whole situation in Genesis 1 was the Eretz under judgment, and then the Spirit of God comes and creates and prepares this land again for his people to live in. So you can understand why this is exactly the sort of language that would be used by the prophets prophesying a restoration, that there Israel or Judah were in Babylon, hang their harps on the willows and weeping as they remembered Zion. Everything seemed so pointless, the land was in ruins, judged by God, by the waters, as it were, of the Babylonian armies. And then the message is that just as God formed Eden or the Eretz for you, for Adam, back then, so he can do today, and so he will do. And so, as I say, this is in essence what we need to hear as well, because we are part of this new creation.